I'll never forget one of the first clients I had as a therapist. He was a Korean-American kid, and he was really rebellious. His parents forced him to go to therapy. He was 17, 18, 19 or something. And he was a great guy. We had a great relationship. We'd joke around a lot. And his parents thought that he wasn't doing well enough in school, and he was defying too many rules and, you know, the typical kind of stuff that parents force their kids into therapy for. And one day he came into session, and he was really morose. And I asked him what was wrong, and he said, "Oh, nothing, nothing." And I said, "No, no, no, tell me, you know, I'd like to know." And it took a while for him to tell me, but he eventually told me this story. He was at his house, and his uncle said, "Hey, how about you come over later today and we'll shoot baskets or do something." And this was an uncle that lived nearby, and he really loved his uncle. And his uncle was a fun guy. And it was like, yeah, get out of the house, hang out with my uncle. Yes, it's going to be great. So he goes over to his uncle's house, and his uncle is in the garage with a few other relatives. And the uncle waves him into the garage, says, "Come on into the garage." And then this kid enters the garage. They close the garage door, and they proceed to beat him. And then they say afterwards, "We did this because you're disrespecting your family, you're disrespecting your community, your parents, your culture, your religion. And if you don't get your, you know, stuff in order, then we're going to do this again." And he, you know, got himself together, walked home, came to therapy and told me this story, and he didn't really know how to see it. He wasn't so much physically hurt as he was emotionally hurt by having his entire family, all the men in his family, basically conspire to trick him into succumbing to a beatdown. And the most surprising thing to me was that he said he deserved it. I'm like, Jiminy Crickets, are you, your whole family beat you? That's terrible. We got to call the authorities. And he said, "Well, no, I mean, this is just my culture. This is the way Koreans are. And I've been disrespectful of my elders, and this is what they do to people like me. You know, this is, they probably should have done this a long time ago. I don't like it, but, you know, I don't think you understand, Kirk. This is a cultural thing." And it was at that moment that I started wondering, I started saying, well, okay, a cultural thing. I've been really, you know, taught to respect other people's cultures. I'm a young therapist, so I have never run into this before. But at the same time, in my gut, I know that this is wrong. Families can't beat their kids. That's just not okay, especially in a manner like this, where you're basically like, you know, beaten by a gang of your family. That's not right. It's not good parenting. It's not moral. It's wrong to do that. But then I went back to the other side. I said, but he's saying this is cultural, and I've been taught that we're supposed to respect other cultures, be sensitive to other cultures, and not to assume that my culture is the right culture. But something's wrong here. And so I'll never forget this, because that was when I began the real journey of cultural understanding and cultural discourse as a therapist. Before that, I had engaged in intellectual discussions. I'd read books and heard other people talk, but I'd never really been at that crux between what I described, between respecting another culture and seeing the other culture as informing me what they do, so to speak, allowing other cultures, quote unquote, to do what they do, while at the same time wondering if I should intervene regardless, or if I should, at the very least in my head, evaluate another cultural practice as not being a good thing. That's where the rubber meets the road. When it comes to cultural discussions, we can have all sorts of intellectual discussions, but as a clinician, the rubber meets the road where you actually are in a position of power as a therapist when you're treating clients and families. You're in a position where you can actually influence the situation and engage in a discourse with clients to change things. And I've been in many other clinical situations since then that are similar. And I've talked a lot, and I've thought a lot, and I've read a lot, and I've been wrong a lot, and I've asked a lot of questions of people that are wiser than me. And so that's what I want to talk about today. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Program at Antioch University, Seattle, and I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist. This episode was prompted by a patron of the podcast. She wrote, "Hi, Kirk. How do you deal with people who assert that abusive behavior is intrinsic to their culture and therefore okay and off limits to someone outside their culture, suggesting modification? Here are some situations I have experienced. An African-American person abusing a child by beating the child with a belt. A Filipino person verbally abusing his wife. A Chinese-American teenager being abused for not doing well in school. All these people insist that this is how it is in their cultures, and they insist that an American white person like me could never understand. And they insist it is oppressive for a white person to see the abuse as problematic. I feel overly anxious and immobilized due to my whiteness and relative privilege. However, there are really ingrained ways of viewing women and children as objects in many cultures, and somehow it seems more intimidating to me when they back it up with quote-unquote culture because of so much of my own indoctrination into cultural relativism and respecting other cultures. I want to ask the following question, but I can't because it's potentially insulting. I want to ask, are all cultures healthy?" End quote. Okay. I love this question. It's a very good question. Best question of the year. Often a question not asked by white people, or if it's asked, it's in a hushed tone. I get this question all the time. The short answer is, there is no answer. That's the short answer. The long answer is, there is no answer. It's the answer lies in a discourse. In this podcast, I'll add to the discourse, but I'm not going to answer this question. I can't. It's like if someone, fly to the moon and walk around and fly back, and then someone asks you, what does it really feel like to walk on the moon? Well, there's no way you can just verbally describe that to somebody so that they really know what it's like to walk on the moon. You can approximate it and you can give it your best shot, but no one would say that through language you could describe what it really is like to walk on the moon. And that's the same here. When it comes to being a therapist, when it comes to cultural relativism, postmodernism, social constructionism, all these things, you can't just answer these questions with an answer. You have to engage in a discourse. And through that discourse, with all its various dilemmas and contradictions, a gestalt will emerge over time that will guide you and be a paradigm from which you can operate. And so this podcast is a part of that and is an expression of my own gestalt. But let's review your questions. You didn't say these words, but these are the questions that I'm inferring from what you're saying. Question number one, do some cultures possess beliefs and practices that are harmful or immoral or bad? Number two, how should clinicians approach clients who have abusive beliefs and practices that are intrinsic to their culture? Number three, Is it off limits and oppressive for a white privileged American to suggest modification of an abusive cultural practice? Number four, do clients have the right to insist that that's just the way their culture is? Number five, are white privileged Americans unable to understand and evaluate beliefs and practices of other cultures? What number am? Number seven, is it all cultural relativism and therefore unknowable? Number eight, are all cultures healthy? You actually did ask that question. Number nine, is it insulting and racist to even ask these questions? Okay, so let's take these questions one by one. First, do some cultures possess beliefs and practices that are harmful or immoral or bad? The answer is yes. It's particularly obvious in extreme examples. Culture of the United States of America, our society, our culture, endorsed many different notions to enslave Africans in the United States. It wasn't just the fact that enough Americans thought it was okay to enslave Americans, but they also had a lot of other kinds of cultural beliefs and practices that went along with that, like black people are lesser. Black people, slaves are possessions, not actual people. You can beat them. You don't have to give them rights. You don't have to let them vote. You don't have to, there's all these cultural beliefs and practices that went along with that. So we can look back in time at that culture and say, there was something wrong with that culture. That is not okay. And if a client came to you and was enslaving black people, for instance, then it's not cultural relativism, that guides that. You can't, no one can say like, well, everything's culturally relative, so it's okay to enslave black people. No, it's not. But that's an easy example to point to. Other examples from, the current time, a culture that advocates and actually does mutilate the genitals of girls. There are current cultures that do that. It gets a little weird when you start cross-culture evaluation, but for me, I'm comfortable with saying, after thinking about it and looking at it at this topic enough, that cultural practice is wrong and bad, even though it is absolutely a part of particular cultures and embedded in those cultures. And taking that away would feel like a cultural atrocity to those people, and that's how it feels to them. Regardless of all of that, it's wrong, and no one should be doing that. Or take another culture that doesn't permit women to become educated. Again, it's obvious that to not allow half of the population, just because they're female, to have any kind of power, like the little bit of power that education gives you, is just wrong. It's not the point is like, it's obvious to me that some cultural practices are wrong, and meaning that they harm people unnecessarily. There's no reason, really good reason, to do these things. The enslavement of Africans was an economic decision, a way of building up, labor, having cheap labor, so that American colonists could make a lot of money growing tobacco, essentially. And that's not a good enough reason to do that. Now, if they were trying to save the human race or something, or I don't know, there was some higher minded benefit to the enslavement of Africans, maybe I could see that being justified. It's hard to imagine such a thing. But the point is that when you look at it within its context, there's not a good reason to oppress people in that way, or to treat people in that way, or to see things in that way. And therefore, in my estimation, it's not good. Now, can science prove that those things are bad? No. It's all based on what you privilege. I privilege the non-harming of other people whenever possible, or to minimize the harm on people whenever ever possible. I also privilege equality based on, you know, that everyone gets the same chance in life, that you can't just single out a group of people and say you get less of a chance in life. That's just not fair. It's not right. And so to me, these are easy examples. So to your question, do some cultures possess beliefs and practices that are harmful or immoral or bad? The answer is yes. And in the obvious situations, it's easy to identify. However, in less obvious situations, which is the vast majority of situations, it's much harder to evaluate. But I'll get into more of that later. Another question that you were basically asking were, are all cultures healthy? Are all cultures healthy? Let me get into that after the break. Let's take a break. What do you say? All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't already, become a patron of the podcast. Go to patreon.com. Do it now. Come on, people. We've had a bit of a lag in new patrons, so you could make me happy by becoming a patron. I get a little notification every time someone becomes a patron, and it just warms my heart to see that people actually care. It's nice for you, nice of you, and nice for me, and nice for the podcast. The more patrons you have, the more time I can spend on deep dives and other kinds of things. So do it. Do it now. Okay. Are all cultures healthy? This is similar to the last question. It's easy to evaluate in the extreme, but hard to evaluate for most issues. I mean, even in the extreme, it's hard to evaluate, really. It depends on what you privilege. You know, like I was saying, in the West, we privilege freedom and equality. In other cultures, they don't privilege that. So it gets a little weird when you consider that even the foundations of our culture are not necessarily universal. For example, the freedom of the press. There are many pros and cons to this. I personally value freedom in general, and particularly freedom of the press. But some cultures don't really hold this value. They might privilege harmony and conformity over freedom. And they privilege harmony over freedom of the press, or freedom of speech, or freedom of information. Which is, quote unquote, better? Well, it's all relative. It's hard to know. Having said that, that doesn't mean we need to just give up and say, well, it's all cultural relativism. It's all postmodernism. There's no way to know, so we'll just stop right there. No, we can continue to investigate and participate in a discourse about it, and through that discourse, new wisdoms might be uncovered and truly felt by people participating in the discourse. For me, I've engaged in that discourse, the discourse between freedom and harmony, and I've realized that both cultures can be good. And I define good as, again, minimal harm to humans and the environment. However, as a person raised in a freedom-oriented culture, I would never want to live in a harmony-oriented culture. It would drive me berserk. But that's different than intellectually understanding that both cultures are good. One culture feels good, the other culture feels bad to me, but I know that both cultures are good. If I was raised in a harmony-oriented culture, I would probably be cool with it and see the benefit of it because I would be indoctrinated into it. Now, this isn't to say that all people are happy with the culture they're raised in. And this also isn't to say that everything about a harmony-oriented culture is good and everything about a freedom-oriented culture is good. The point is that, I hope you get my point. Your question, are all cultures healthy? The answer is yes and no. Hard to tell. If you engage in discourse over it, you can zero in on a so-called answer. Are some elements of some cultures unhealthy? Yes, when they're in the extreme. But when they're in the nuanced, you know, it's hard to tell. But I'll get more into that later. Another question that I inferred from your email, patron, was, are white privileged Americans unable to understand and evaluate beliefs and practices of other cultures? The answer is no. White people, white privileged Americans are perfectly able to understand and evaluate beliefs and practices of other cultures, just like anyone else. I mean, if none of us were able to understand or evaluate any culture, then we'd be screwed, right? Now, if you come from the dominant culture, which is the white privileged American culture, I have to apply this to everyone because we have people in other countries. So I just want to say, if you come from the dominant culture in your region, it will be much, much harder to understand another culture and to evaluate it. People who exist outside the dominant culture are much more able to see and understand cultural realities. For example, a black man who is raised within black culture, he understands black culture, but he interfaces with white culture as soon as he leaves his house. So he becomes an expert in both black culture and white culture. And by becoming an expert in two cultures, he sees that his culture isn't the only culture. He sees that, oh, there is another culture, there is another way of doing things, and I've seen it in all of its nuance, but I also see my culture. So, however, if you are white, cisgender, heterosexual, American, what other identification am I missing here? If you, male, I suppose, Christian, if you grow up with those identities in a pocket of the United States that is dominantly that, then it's really hard to understand culture because you're so immersed in your culture, you don't even notice that you're in a culture. That's the danger of being drowning in your own culture, is that you tend to assume that your culture is the best way of doing things and is the only way of doing things. And when you see another culture, you tend to see it as aberrant and strange and wrong. Whereas if you grow up early as sort of aware of how culture influences things, you have a better critical mind when it comes to even your own culture. I hope you get my picture on that. For me, I grew up as half Japanese, half white, half Japanese American, half European American. And being Japanese and Asian in the 70s was a much worse thing than it is now. And so I, think of it as kind of like growing up like you're a black person. It felt that way to me as I was growing up. I didn't feel like today I walk around, especially in Seattle, there's a lot of Asians. I feel pretty normal walking around. And I even have friends that will say to me things like, "You're not Asian. You're just a guy." And I don't want to yell at them, but I want to yell at them and say, "You can't just take away my identity like that. I'm Japanese, my friend. And as a white person, I realize you want to see me as white, but I'm not. I'm half white." It's like saying Obama is white. Obama's half black. It's like, I'm not, Obama's not white and I'm not white. I'm half white, but I'm not white. I'm half Japanese, half Asian. And so as a person growing up with that paradox, I think that helped me to see culture for what it was and to be more critical, to have a more critical sense of the way in which we see culture. Now, if I had more identities that were outside of the dominant culture, I would be even better at it. So there's that. Imagine you move to another culture, some drastic other culture like India or Japan or Russia or Uganda, depending on where you live, or America. Maybe you live in Uganda. Imagine you move to America and you lived in this foreign land for 5 years. You would become an expert over time in that local culture. Maybe some of you have even done this before. Maybe you've moved to Korea for 5 years. You become an expert in that culture because you have to. There's just no way around it. And it would be easier for you to see that culture and to evaluate that culture because you were not indoctrinated into it. You're an outsider coming in that's like immersed in another culture, and you see all these like weird aspects of it, And you feel the culture every day as like it doesn't feel quite right because it's not the one you were indoctrinated into. That's what it's like for someone in the States who is not from the dominant culture. When I grew up in the States, although my ancestors go back, 100 plus years, I definitely felt like I was outside the dominant culture in some ways. And so I noticed more of the things, just for instance, in my home, we would eat Spam. I talk about this sometimes. As a kid, we would eat Spam or like fried hot dog bits. it's a Japanese American thing to like cut up hot dogs and make them into teriyaki. It sounds super ghetto, and I suppose it is, but to me, it was just like, that's just food, or rice. We called it gohan, but rice was on everything. Every day I probably ate just like 10 bowls of rice. It was just a ubiquitous thing. It's like, it's bigger than bread, in Japanese culture. And so when I grew up and moved out of the house in college, I brought my food with me, and instantly everyone started making fun of me for it because it was mainly white guys, and they would just make fun of me. It's hot dog bits and your weird Spam thing. Well, I could feel where they were coming from eventually, because Spam is gross and teriyaki hot dogs are silly. I get that. But I also 100% get how great Spam is and how great teriyaki hot dogs are. I feel both because I lived in the dominant culture regarding that. And I also was indoctrinated into the culture that said that Spam and hot dog bits are awesome. And so as I grew up, I was like, oh, I get it. The way you feel about something is completely dependent on your culture. To one person, Spam is disgusting. And I get that because I've been exposed to so many people who think Spam is disgusting. But at the same time, I was indoctrinated in a culture that idolizes Spam. I mean, it's sort of weird. It's like Spam is not expensive and it's in every store and it's not hard to prepare. It's actually really easy to prepare. You just, you take out that congealed mass out of the can, you cut off a piece and you throw it on a pan and it browns easily because it comes with its own oil. It has that jelly in it. It just, and it's very, you don't need to add any butter or Pam to the pan. It just fries up real nice. And you serve it with eggs and, it's easy. But for whatever reason, Japanese Americans don't bust it out very often, even though it's easily accessible. It tends to be only busted out at special occasions. And so why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because Spam is almost artificially treated like a rare commodity among Japanese Americans, at least in my circle. So yeah. when I began this podcast, I had no idea I was going to talk about Spam, but there you go. So can white privileged Americans understand and evaluate other cultures? The cultural relativists and the postmodernists would say no, but I say yes, with a massive asterisk that's bigger than the word yes. Everyone, including non-privileged people, have to tread very, very carefully as they, evaluate other cultures, quote unquote, because it's easy to jump to conclusions. And it's easy to harm others with negative evaluations. And there's a long history of white people harming others with their biased evaluations and their harmful practices. And so once you understand that history, you become appreciative of the need to tread very, very carefully when you're talking about other cultures. If you're a white privileged American, you especially have to tread very, very carefully. And you have to assume that half of the shit that pops into your head is probably not helpful. And you have to assume that 90% of your gut reactions to another culture are probably based on culture and nothing other than that. And so, and once you understand history, even the history of psychotherapy and psychology, you will just see countless stories of intelligent, well-educated, well-meaning people who might even know of the words cultural relativism and yet still can't see the woods through the trees. And so we tread very carefully. Now, that's not advice for just white privileged people. That's advice for everybody. We're all potential harmers of other people from our own particular angles. So black people, gay people, transgender people, everyone is capable of being unfair to another person. It's just easier for a white privileged person to be harmful because it's the historical tradition and the dominant culture, you know, because the dominant culture, because you are the dominant culture, it's easier to be, to think as though your notions are always good. But it's true for everybody. Okay. Another question inferred from your email, patron. Is it off limits and oppressive for white privileged Americans to suggest modification of abusive cultural practice? Similar to the last question. And the short answer is no, it's not off limits. Of course, it's not off limits. But again, privileged people have to tread very carefully and consider the cultural context. If you are a person of color and white people have been barking racist things at you your entire life, and, you know, white privileged therapists have been ignoring your culture, and white privileged doctors and dentists have been talking down to you, and then a therapist comes along and makes a blunt suggestion that seems to disregard your culture, then you're not likely to react well to that. At the very least, you're just going to ignore it. And at worst, you're going to, or I don't know, in the extreme situation, you're going to say, shut the fuck up. So white people have to build a robust relationship with people of color before they start making suggestions. That's just a general recommendation. It depends. I have worked with people from other cultures than me and made suggestions within the first 15 minutes of therapy, and I've had it go well. It just depends. There's no absolutes when it comes to therapy. That's what makes this job so wonderful. It's so varied and so unpredictable and so specific to the situation. It's hard to tell. But in general, whenever you're working cross-culturally, but really when you're working with anybody, you want to have a good relationship. You want them to know that you respect them. You want to actually respect them. You want to be genuine in your respect for them and your positive regard for them. And so that takes time, and that takes a lot of work. All right, another question you have. Do clients have the right to insist that's just the way their culture is? Do clients have the right to insist that that's just the way their culture is? The answer is yes. Anyone has the right to say whatever they want to say. But I think what you're asking is it helpful to confront clients even when they claim their behavior is quote unquote cultural? Yeah, it's absolutely potentially helpful to confront people on their quote unquote cultural practices. But you have to have a good enough relationship that can handle that sort of conversation. You can't just tell people what to do. That's not therapy. Therapy is working with people, not against them. Another question you asked basically was, is it all cultural relativism and therefore unknowable? The answer is yes and no. As I was saying earlier, through discourse, we can uncover things and discover things and learn things and feel new things. But you have to engage in that discourse. And if you haven't, then you're likely to see things in a very simplistic way. Let me give an example. In the 90s, for those of you that are old enough, you might remember a debate about Ebonics. I'm going to actually take a break. I'm going to talk about Ebonics after the break. So let's take a break. All All right, we're back. If you haven't already become a patron, do so now. Also, tell a friend or a colleague about the show. You know, word of mouth does a lot. Rate us on iTunes. I saw a few new ratings on iTunes. Thank you so much for that. So, but the biggest thing you could do for the podcast is become a patron. Plus, you benefit from that because you get access to all the premium episodes. But anyway, let's talk about Ebonics. This is, I think, an excellent example for me about discourse, discovery, wisdom, cultural relativism, and how it applies to the real world. Growing up, I would hear people talking with, you know, in the Ebonics way, and I would assume that they were uneducated, stupid, ignorant, wrong, all these things. If you know what Ebonics is, then you know what I'm talking about. But if you don't, it's like I'm not going to approximate it well, but it'd be something like, there ain't no milk in the fridge. You know, there ain't no milk in the fridge. So that is a double negative, which means there is milk in the fridge. So since I don't speak Ebonics, and again, I don't know if that's Ebonics, so, you know, I just have to, you know, you're just going to have to work with me on this, but it's things along those lines. If I don't speak Ebonics, then if I just take that sentence, the way that my dialect speaks is, it's a double negative. You're saying there is milk in the fridge. Or I'll say, you just said a double negative. Don't do that. Or I'll say, you don't say there ain't no. You say there isn't any milk in the fridge. Okay. Again, I don't know if that's Ebonics. So, you know, just take that with a grain of salt. But my point is that there was a way of speaking that I would hear other Americans talking amongst themselves that I would label, and it was often black people, but it's not always black people. And I would label it as ignorant, as the wrong way to speak, as uneducated, as bad grammar. Okay. Then in the 90s, there was this movement among people saying that they wanted to be recognized as speaking Ebonics, because essentially what was happening was white people were telling these black people to not talk like this. They were saying, you don't say there ain't no milk in the fridge. And again, I don't know if that's a good example, but just as an example of an example, there ain't no milk in the fridge. You don't say that's wrong. You're speaking wrong. It's bad grammar. It's incorrect. The right way to speak is, there isn't any milk in the fridge. That's right. The way you speak is wrong. And then the kid's like, well, but that's the way my parents speak, and that's the way my aunt and uncle speak, and that's the way everyone else speaks. And the teacher would say, but, well, that means your parents are wrong. They're incorrect. They're not speaking English right. And so people, you know, were witnessing this and were saying, no, the kids are speaking a different dialect of American English, which is what we're going to call Ebonics. I believe it's like, short for ebony, maybe ebony phonics, or I don't know. Anyway, the point is all I wrote in my notes here was talk about Ebonics. So I didn't look into it. So take everything I'm saying with a grain of salt. I'm just going to tell you my experience. In the 90s, I remember there's this thing called Ebonics. And as it was talked about in the news, I remember myself in the 90s as a 20-something thinking, that's ridiculous. These people are trying to label bad English as Ebonics, as if that's okay, as if that's legitimate English. No, it's wrong. It's incorrect. You don't say there ain't no milk in the fridge. You say there isn't any milk in the fridge. And to say it's Ebonics is wrong. It's a detriment to our society. I remember thinking that. Now, this is before I was a therapist, so take it easy on me. But that's because it felt wrong to me. There ain't no milk in the fridge. That's wrong. I was told that was wrong, and it doesn't feel right to me. It's not how I talk. And so it's wrong, you know? Okay. Now, over the preceding 20 years, slowly over time, I've engaged in many discourses around culture, and specifically around language and dialects. And I've learned a lot about history and the way American English evolved. Because if we went by right and wrong English, then people from England could come to America and say, we're all talking wrong. We're all spelling the word color wrong. We're spelling the word labor wrong. The way we pronounce words is wrong. Our grammar is wrong. Everything's wrong. And if we said, and if they were allowed to say that, then some previous language to them could come to them and say, you're speaking our language wrong, because English is just an adaptation or an integration of some other group of languages. So language is always changing, and there are inevitably dialects that pop up around, you know, different cultural groups and regions and stuff. And so, you know, like the classic Boston accent, you know, pock the ka, is that wrong to say pock ka? There's no R in there. You know, would you say you're wrong? You're supposed to say park the car. Is that wrong? No, it's dialect. It's just different groups of people speak differently. Just like you wouldn't go to Japan and say they're talking wrong because they're not speaking English. It's just a different language, like, you know. And so, as I learned that, and I learned cultural relativism, and I learned the history of Ebonics, because it's actually pretty interesting. It's not just uneducated English. It's actually like a combination of African dialects and English. And, you know, it's an integration, just the same way that English is an integration. You know, dominant American English is an integration. And so, over time, and so I did, but I wasn't studying Ebonics. I was studying all these other things, language and cultural relativism. And then all of a sudden, the topic of Ebonics came to me again just a few years ago, or maybe even recently. And suddenly I looked at the same exact topic of Ebonics. And 20 years later, I saw a completely different reality. In the 90s, I saw Ebonics as this stupid thing that was justifying bad grammar. In in 2017 now, I look at Ebonics as it's a dialect. It's a legitimate dialect, just like any other dialect. And the only reason why we tend to look down on it is because it's associated with people that we oppress. If black people ruled America, then they would be oppressing the other form of American English, and they would say, look, it's not there isn't any milk in the fridge. It's there ain't no milk in the fridge. Because, you know, it's all a matter of who's in power. It's all a matter of who writes the textbook. It's the textbooks. It's all a matter of who writes the laws and who has the power to say this is right and this is wrong. And so this is cultural relativism is, you know, how do we know things? In the 90s, I knew something, and now I know something different, which is right and which is wrong. I can't say that the way I see it right now is right. I can only say that the way I see it now is the result of a lot of discourse and a lot of integration of a lot of different knowledge areas. So there's no right or wrong when it comes to nuanced cultural discussion and evaluation. There's the only thing we can say is this is what emerges for me after considering many, many factors and after participating in many discourses, after contemplating many things. So that's an example of, you know, so you ask the basically ask the question, is it all cultural relativism and therefore unknowable? And the answer is yes, it is all cultural relativism, but we can quote unquote know things through discourse and discovery. All right. Another question that you seem to be asking is, and I love these questions, they're wonderful questions, best questions of the year. Is it insulting and racist to ask these questions? No, we need to ask these questions. People might see it as racist, but they have a simplistic understanding of the necessary discourses involved in discovering wisdom regarding race and other other cultural topics. If these questions are determined as quote unquote racist, then we are truly lost in the woods without any way to get out. We need to ask questions and talk about this. Otherwise, how are we ever going to find our way out of the woods? You know, people often shy away from these questions, but you, patron emailer, you're brave enough to ask these questions, and I commend you for that. Asking questions is one of the best things you can do as a therapist, and it's one of the best things you can do as a cultural explorer. All right. The last question that you seem to be asking is the one I want to go into in most detail. And this is where the rubber meets the road. You ask, how should clinicians approach clients who have abusive beliefs and practices that are intrinsic to their culture? How should clinicians approach clients who have abusive beliefs and practices that seem to be intrinsic in their culture? Number one, build a relationship. I talk about this frequently. It's something that a lot of therapists fail to do or even fail to recognize as an important step. A lot of times, especially in family therapy, we interface with one person of the system and we just expect everyone else in the system to have a good relationship with us. But that's silly. If you want to engage with the parents, then you have to have a good relationship with them. Otherwise, you might as well not even begin therapy with those people. So build a relationship first. This can't be overstated. That means that you build positive regard, empathy. You listen well. You manage your countertransference. You access your compassion. You get to know them. You speak in their language. You get them to like you. You get them to like to talk to you. This is all done before any confrontation begins. So that's very important. Number two, prove that you're open to being wrong. This is very important. If you're not open to being wrong, you might as well not even start. You've been wrong billions of times in your life. I've been wrong billions of times in my life. But my narcissism prevents me from really truly realizing how many times I've been wrong. Therapists tend to be the sort of people who have been right a lot in their life. They have master's degrees or doctorate degrees. They're smart people. They know things. They probably grew up knowing things. They probably grew up getting good grades. They're known for knowing things and they're known for being right. And they take pride in being right. But everyone's been wrong a billion times over, especially when it comes to cultural ideas. And so you've really got to know that about yourself. And you've got to prove to your clients that you're open to that. Be humble. You know, as an example, you might say, as a white person, I have a particular way of looking at that. You know, say you're talking about parenting. As a white person, I have a particular way of looking at parenting. So maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like there might be some other ways to discipline your child that might not only be more effective, but also will be less harmful to your child's self-esteem. Would you like to explore that? So you're tentatively offering something up. You're asking if they want to explore something, and maybe they'll say, no, I don't want to explore that. And then you'll say, okay, that's fine. That, you know, it's your time. And then in your mind, you say, I obviously haven't built up enough rapport with this person to engage in this conversation. They don't trust me yet. So this isn't, you know, indication that you have to dig in further. It means you have to go back to the drawing board and build a relationship. But prove that you're open to being wrong. You know, say things like, and I say this all the time to everyone because I truly believe it. I'll throw things out to people. I'll be like, you know, I don't know, maybe you should try this. How does that sound? You know, I only say this because, you know, this and this and that, but you know, I could be wrong. And I'm not manipulating people. I'm not saying I could be wrong because I'm just trying to suck them into, you know, saying that I'm not wrong. I truly believe that most of the suggestions I give people are probably not helpful and are probably overly simplistic. I get part of that has to do with experience. I have suggested so many things to clients and later realized that it was a stupid thing to suggest that I've realized that any suggestion that comes out of my mouth is likely to be stupid. You know, the fact that you talk to someone for five sessions for a total of 5 hours, and somehow you know exactly what to do, and they've been living their life for 40 years, and they don't know what to do. The chance that in 5 hours you're going to be able to figure out the right answer is pretty slim, right? So, you know, just make sure you know in your soul that you can be wrong, and make sure you tell your client that, because that'll help. Number three, talk openly about your cultural difference and maybe even your cultural countertransference. For example, you might say, "So, would you like to talk about other cultures and our cultures and see if we have any differences that might come up in therapy?" Now, I asked it in a kind of clunky way, but if you ask it in a good way, you know, a lot of clients will say yes to that in my experience. Another example, I might say, just for me personally, I might say, "So, I grew up in Sammamish, Washington, which is, you know, not far from here. It was mostly rural back then, so I kind of feel like a country boy who now lives in the city. Ethnicity-wise, I'm half Japanese and half Caucasian. I identify as cisgender, identify as a male, and identify as heterosexual. I'm 46 years old. I grew up in a Christian home, but now I'm just kind of agnostic. I tell you this because I know that my culture affects the way that I look at the world. And I'm always trying to be aware of how my biases affect how I see things and how I treat others. And I'd love to talk about where you came from and how that informs who you are and how you see things." So, you know, something like that. And then I might proceed to listen to their experience without judgment, asking, you know, probing questions, curious questions. "Oh, you grew up in Alabama. You know, what's it like in Alabama? What part of Alabama? Was it rural? Was it city? What'd you like about Alabama? What'd you dislike about Alabama? What, you know, how do people from Alabama see things differently than people in Seattle?" "Oh, they see it like that. Oh, okay. I can respect that. I see that." You know, you want to just, you know, it's in our culture today, we tend to privilege particular groups of people. I bring up Alabama because many people in the North will denigrate people from Alabama. They'll be like, or Florida. They use these, you know, Southern country or Southern states as punchlines, you know. It's like, "Oh, so in Florida news, ha ha ha," you know. It's like, it's a joke. And that influences all of us depending on where you come from in the culture. And so you need to pay extra attention and extra energy to making sure you respect other people. Okay, so before moving on, let's take a breaky break. Breaky, 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 break. Okay, we're back. Number four, learn about other cultures. This is easy to say, but it's hard to do. As I've learned about other cultures and exposed myself to other cultures, I've realized that there are many ways to do a lot of different things, mainly raise other children. Some of these other ways, include what seems to me to be very harsh parenting or very bad parenting. To me, when I see their parenting, I will feel like it's abusive or bad or just, you know, not right. But it's not necessarily bad or abusive. For instance, with the aspect of being harsh or being stern, when, and science has demonstrated this, empirical science has demonstrated this, that when you involve, when if, you know, specifically, there's been studies that have looked at Chinese culture in terms of general Chinese parenting culture and how they tend to be more harsh to their kids. Well, what they, you know, so they went into the study trying to see whether or not that harshness equated into bad outcomes for the kids. But what they found was that that the Chinese parents in general they're not just harsher with their kids. They're also way more involved in their kids' life. And they notice the kids more often. They tend to the kids more often. And so the kids, they feel like their parents are being harsh to them sometimes, but they also feel like their parents really care and are fully 110% dedicated to them. Now, this isn't all Chinese parents. There's over a billion of them. But but in contrast to Western or, you know, mainstream American parents, that contrast can be seen sometimes. Whereas in mainstream American culture, we tend to be, in contrast to other cultures, a little bit more hands-off when it comes to kids, even though we're increasingly more and more hands-on. And so when you just are harsh and critical and stern, but you don't have the, you don't match that up with increased warmth and increased involvement, then it produces kids who feel much more hurt than if you have the harshness matched up with a lot more warmth, as it is in other cultures. Also, it can't be understated the importance of the cultural context. So if you're in China and you and all your friends are being treated harshly by all the parents, then it doesn't feel abnormal. It feels like, well, that's just the way parents parent their kids. And as long as it's within a certain limit of harshness, it won't feel bad to you, you know? It won't feel like abuse. It'll feel like your parents are passionate about making sure that you are a success in life or that you are a good person or whatever it is that the parents are reacting to. Now, having said that, I could talk for hours and hours and hours about that topic I just said, about the differences between Chinese parenting and mainstream American parenting, and what is Chinese parenting and what is mainstream American parenting. I could, you know, there's a lot of variability in there. So as you can see, when we talk about cultural examples, they quickly blossom into a very complicated conversation that doesn't lend itself to simple examples. So as with all things in culture and all things in psychotherapy, it's complicated. So, and involve, you know, and you have to involve yourself in a discourse. So, number five, you want to self-disclose. It's always a good idea to self-disclose. Self-disclose about your culture. Self-disclose that you don't understand cultures. Self-disclose that, you know, you, patron, it sounds to me like you have some clients that you're, you know, like you gave an example of an African American family. Let's see, I'm scrolling up in my notes here. Where an African American person abusing a child by beating the child with a belt. Well, part of your approach after building a relationship, after talking about culture, you can self-disclose and just say, look, I'm going to tell you, for me and my culture, hitting a child with a belt is wrong. But I don't know if it's actually wrong, but I'm just here to tell you that it feels wrong to me. So I just got to tell you that. And, but I respect you, the way you do things. And, but I don't know, maybe we could have a conversation about that. Or you could self-disclose around like, your own parenting, or you could self-disclose around cultural norms, you know, like what's something I could say? I could say something like with the Ebonics thing. I could say, I grew up thinking that Ebonics was a bad thing. And then the more and more I learned about it, the more I realized that it's just another legitimate dialect of a language, of English. And that was a hard pill to swallow because I probably told a lot of people that I thought Ebonics was stupid. So, you know, I don't know if that's a great example, but the point is that you want to self-disclose because that goes a long way with people. It also provides an example, a model for people to follow, and it also demotes you because you don't, depending on your style of therapy, but a lot of styles of therapy today try to involve some element of elevating the client, which means demoting yourself. Anyway, number six. Give parents replacement behaviors or give people replacement behaviors rather than taking behaviors away. This is very important. And you have to give good ones. Don't give stupid ones. Like, you know, you really want, for instance, with parenting, you really want to learn how to instruct and guide parents regarding different parenting practices. Like you have a parent that's hitting the kid with a belt, and you determine over time that it would probably be better for the kid if the kid wasn't hit by a belt. Well, then you think, well, what's a replacement parenting practice? Well, maybe timeouts would be better. So instead of just saying, do timeouts instead, you have to get really good at instructing it and guiding parents through it, because it takes months to change a parenting practice like that. And you also have to be good at convincing people of things. I've often thought that therapy, depending on the, especially couple and family therapy, but individual therapy can be this way too. I've often thought that therapy is basically a manifestation of diplomacy. If you are extremely diplomatic, you'll be much more effective as a therapist. The ability to have empathy for someone in terms of where they are regarding your suggestion is extremely helpful. And the ability to sort of know where they're at and sort of guide them down that road in a way that they do volitionally, is that a word? That they do willingly, is all about diplomacy. If you just bluntly tell people, you know, stop hitting your kid with a belt and start doing timeouts, you know, that's the opposite of diplomacy, right? You've got to work diplomatically with people. And you also might want to demonstrate how it's done. You might want to actually say, okay, I'm going to demonstrate it, you know. Hey, Johnny, let's say that you just broke a rule. Now I'm going to do that, you know, show them how it's done. Now, this isn't telling people what to do, but if you're going to truly commit to helping someone change, you might have to really commit to demonstrating exactly how it's done. Okay. So let's get back to the situations you presented. One situation you presented, so an African-American person abusing a child by beating the child with a belt. I've seen this. You know, I've seen this. I've had African-American parents say to me things like, if that kid doesn't clean his room, I'm going to whoop him so hard. He is going to get a whooping like he has never felt before. And to my therapist ears, that's abuse. You know, that's mandated reporting kind of stuff. To the culture that I grew up in, that's abuse. To the dominant American culture, that's abuse. And so it feels weird, but I've seen it so many times with African-American families, not all African-American families, of course, but many African-American families and white families too of a particular region will talk like this. And at first I just thought, whoa, 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 whoa. But then over time I began to see it within its context and be a lot less bothered by it, honestly. So I've seen this. So you present a situation, an African-American person abusing a child by beating the child with a belt. Now, I want to say up front that maybe this person is actually abusing a child by any definition and therefore needs to stop. So I'm not going to say it's all cultural relativism. But we need to be very careful not to impose our culture on other people. It's possible that this behavior is a good thing. To me, it feels horrible to think about any parent hitting their child with a belt. It feels horrible to me. And if I saw that, I would want to stop it. But as a therapist, I have to understand that my gut reaction is not a good measure of right or wrong or good parenting. You know, that's very important to recognize. So you want to build a relationship with that person. You want to have discussions of culture. You want to prove that you're open to talking about culture. You want to prove that you're willing to accept that your cultural interpretations are not right. And you want to offer other ways of providing discipline that don't insult them. And you want to potentially not even touch the belt thing. You want to say, okay, so you discipline with the belt. How else do you discipline? And they're like, well, I don't know. And you say, okay, well, how would you like to add more things to your repertoire? Because, you know, when parents have a lot of options, they tend to do better. So how about we add a few other options? How do you feel about that? They're like, well, okay. And you say, well, there's this thing called timeout. And maybe it's goofy, maybe it's not for you, but let me demonstrate it. It's really, I found it to be really effective with a lot of parents. Let me demonstrate it to you. And, you know, you demonstrate it, you go on a campaign over months maybe to integrate that. And then over time, they just stop doing the belt thing because they either don't need to do it, or you say, okay, now that the timeout thing is really working, maybe we could scale back on the belt thing because the belt thing might actually be hurting the kid's self-esteem and might actually be really kind of traumatizing for the child. And it might be, I don't know, let's see if we can do without that for a bit and see what that does. What you don't say is, that's abusive, stop doing that. You know, at the first time you hear that, you know, someone is disciplining their child with a belt, you don't just say, by the way, that's abusive, you need to stop doing that. You know, what if I did that to you? Now, I'm not saying, patron, you did this, but just as an example, as the, you know, royal you. What if I did that to somebody? I just entered their house. I observed the way that they parented. And then I just told them to stop it. Just stop doing your parenting way. You know, how would that feel? That would feel pretty shitty, you know? And so you have to be really careful about that. Now, having said that, some people are extremely stubborn as clients. And they're not open to change. And they refuse to listen to good advice. Or they suffer from PTSD or some other trauma reaction that you know, makes it hard for them to react well to their kids. So, you know, there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed before changes can occur. And you really have to look at people and family systems in a holistic manner. A lot of times I see therapists will really focus on this belt thing. You know, they'll say, so I got this family where the parent is using the belt to discipline their kids. And I've got to put an end to that. And I'll say, well, okay, you know, let's talk about that. Tell me more about the family. Well, the mother's, you know, she's, you know, very strapped for money. She's working 50 hours a week. The dad isn't in the picture. She has three kids. She doesn't have any friends. She drinks alcohol every night. She isn't getting good sleep. She's overweight. The kids are mostly left to their own devices. They live in a bad neighborhood, and there are scary, you know, things that happen. You know, you hear gunshots almost every night. You know, the list goes on and on and on. So to just focus on the belt thing ignores the larger system at play. And so we, as family therapists, we treat everything. Let's look at the mom. Let's look at the kids. Let's look at the neighborhood. Let's look at the schools. Let's look at their extended family. Let's look at their friends. You know, let's look at the whole picture. If I just say the belt thing has got to stop and that's all that I do, what am I doing? You know? So anyway, another situation you provided, a Filipino person who verbally abuses his wife. So to this, you know, it's the same. Build a relationship with the Filipino person. Prove that you're open and culturally sensitive. Discuss culture openly with this person. Make sure that they're ready for change. You know, this is key. If he doesn't want to change, then there's not much you can do. And this is something I talk with a lot of people about, particularly beginning therapists, because beginning therapists tend to get a lot of clients who actually don't want to change. And so a lot of beginning therapists start thinking it's their job to change people who don't want to be changed. It's sort of like they start thinking, oh, I see. Being a therapist is forcing people to change who don't want my help. And it's like, no. You know, if a Filipino man came you know, say you're treating a family and you figure out that the dad is, you know, abusing the mom. Just because you see something terribly wrong is happening doesn't mean that you have the power to change it. It doesn't even mean you should even engage in conversations around it. If you want to engage in conversations about it, you sit the dad down, maybe even one-on-one, and you say, so I'm getting the impression that you and your wife have some conflicts. And I was just wanting to know if you ever wanted to talk about that with me. Do you want to work on that? And if he's like, no, I don't want to talk to you. You're not my therapist, I don't trust you. And I want to, then you don't, you know? And one of the tragedies of being a therapist is you might just have to watch that abuse happening without being able to actually do anything about it. Now, by not doing anything about it, I mean not actually trying to engage in therapeutic interventions with the Filipino man. If you wanted to provide advocacy resources for the wife, then by all means. Or you want to talk with the wife about how she can advocate for herself, then by all means do that. But the point is that when you see something and they claim that it's cultural, they might be just saying, back off, I don't want to talk about it with you. And, you know, people have the right to refuse treatment. So it's just another thing to think about. But anyway, so build a relationship, prove that you're open and culturally sensitive, discuss culture openly, make sure they're ready for change. Once, you know, they say they're ready for change, then provide other methods. Treat the whole person and the whole system. Maybe he suffers from PTSD. Maybe he feels culturally oppressed and he's taking it out on his wife. Maybe there's a systemic problem that's perpetuating his behavior. Maybe he needs to recover from his own abusive childhood. So, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be considered. Then suggest the elimination of the behavior and or it'll just go away naturally. Now, what I'm describing to you can take months, if not years. And I could absolutely see therapy not working for a person like this. But the point is that we don't just, you know, the way that the patron is writing it, and she's not saying this directly, but, well, I'll just say this. I've seen clinicians, they will interface with a client, and like this Filipino person, and they'll interface with, you know, they'll get the set, wait, it looks like, I think this dad is abusing his wife. And then the therapist says to the wife, you might even say, like, so it sounds to me like your husband is abusing you. And then she might say something, oh, no, no, you don't get it. That's just the way Filipino men are. That's our culture. And then you go to the man and you say, you know what? I think there's another way to try to manage conflict in your marriage. I think what you're doing is a little abusive. And then he says, oh, no, no, you don't get it. You don't get it. That's just the way things are. That's just the way, you know, our culture is. And then you go back home and you think about it, and then you see him the next session and you say, I don't care if it's a cultural thing. You guys need to stop this. And the wife and the husband are looking at you like, you don't get it. See, that's what I see happening. Or I see clinicians going home and just being frustrated and saying like, well, I'm supposed to respect other people's culture, but I don't get this. So again, build a relationship. Get them to like you. Get them to the point where they love talking to you. Start talking about culture and cultural interpretation so that when they say it's a Filipino thing, you already have a way of discussing what a Filipino thing even means. So they say, well, you know, so you build a relationship. They love you. Then you say, you know what? I kind of feel like some of this stuff feels a little harsh, you know, and I don't know if this is the best way for managing conflict between you two. And then the wife says, oh, you know, you don't understand. Filipino men, it's just, you know, it's Filipino culture. You can't change it. Well, you would have already talked about culture. So you might say something like, well, okay. So what you're saying is that it's culturally normal for Filipino men to treat their wives harshly like that. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Okay. So I, being from American culture, it's going to be hard for me to understand that because I come from another culture. But I want to respect your culture, and maybe you know, I'll be convinced that this is something that, you know, is okay and should be perpetuated. But, you know, I want to, let's talk about this for a second. Let's talk about this. Are there other ways that you can be Filipino in the management of your conflict that would feel better for the two of you? You know, what do you think? And they're like, well, I don't know. Well, okay, well, let's, you know. So, you know, I'm sort of blunt forcing this example, but I hope you get it, that it's a part of a larger conversation, and it's a part of a discourse that you have with clients, a respectful discourse. It's not a matter of saying, I don't care if it's cultural, it's wrong, you know. That's not the path to actual change. Another example that you gave was a Chinese American teen being abused for not doing well in school. Yeah, I've seen white Americans bungle this one all the time. You know, white American clinicians who work with Asian families will often become appalled at how intense they are about grades. You know, whenever I have Asian teens who are not, you know, that are quote unquote struggling as teenagers, it's funny because they're often getting really good grades. Like with non-Asian teenagers, one of the first things that will suffer is grades. You know, like when they're in the ninth grade, they'll get all F's. And then the next thing, they're smoking pot every day. And then the next thing, they're punching their dad in the face every now and then. And then the next thing, they're shoplifting. You know, like there's a certain progression. The first thing to go is grades. But with Asian families, it's the opposite. I have seen full gang, violent, Asian, scary, defiant teenagers who steal cars. I had one Asian kid who stole a car every day for a month and didn't get caught. And, you know, cocaine and selling substances and, you know, not going to, maybe not even going to school all the time. And yet they're getting A's and B's in their school, in, you know, at school, because education is so important to some Asian families that it just, you know, it really affects these kids to the point where they'll much more readily do other things before they would ever let their grades go down. So anyway, now you're at, you know, white Americans, white privileged Americans working with these Asian families. Then what I'll see these clinicians do is they'll just tell the parents to relax, you know, let it go. Who cares about grades? And that is a massive cultural misunderstanding and an oppressive attitude towards Asian families. To relax on grades for some Asian families is akin to severe neglect of your kids. And that's not like Asian families and their weird culture. Every culture has a culture, including mainstream American culture. And so every culture's conceptualization of education is a cultural element, and all of them are okay, is the thing. The fact that Asians are super intense about grades is fine. The fact that some American families are not super intense on grades is also fine. It's just, it's all variability within the okay limits of variance of parenting and culture. Now, The way parents focus on grades is often the issue, because we can say that, you know, 95% of Asian parents are super intense about grades, but are 95% of Asian parents abusive to their kids? No. Are 95% of Asian parents producing kids that are very upset about this whole thing about grades? No. It's the way the parents focus on grades. So parents can be super intense about grades, but they can be empathic and attuned and loving. Or they can be super intense about grades and dismissive and discounting and rejecting. And so to just look at a family and say, you need to lay off on the grades, completely misses the point. The point is not to tell them to conform to your culture. The point is to look deeper. The human, the thing that crosses all cultures is that all kids want love. Every human wants love, aside from psychopaths. But everyone wants love. Everyone wants attention. Everyone wants empathy. Everyone wants self-esteem. Everyone wants to have a good time with their loved ones. So the fact that one culture is intense on grades and another culture is not has nothing to do with those realities that are human universals. In the same way, hitting a kid with a belt is not necessarily related to the idea of being loved and cared for, paid attention to, all those human universal things. We tend to focus on these behaviors as proxies for the more relevant things in humans' lives, but that misses the cultural context. I don't know if I'm explaining this quite well, but I hope you get it. Let me just say it again regarding the Asian families. A family comes to you and there's a problem. And the first thing you see with your cultural lens is the parents are super intense about grades and a lot of conflict is arising about grades. The kid is only getting C's and the parents are grounding the kid. They don't let the kid, watch TV, all because the kid has C's. And now the kid is depressed and upset and runs away from home sometimes and smokes pot. And so you, with your cultural eyes, say, these Asian parents, they got to lay off on the grades. That's what needs to happen. Well, to say that to an Asian family is akin to saying, I want you to take your kid and throw them in a river and forget them. For some Asian families, to relax on grades is literally, it will literally feel that way to them. And so that's a simplistic way of looking at systems. But so you put that aside and you join the system, you get to know it, you get really in there. And then you discover that it's not really about grades, because a lot of Asian parents are super intense about grades. What it really is about is that the boy doesn't know if his parents really love him. And you go to the parents and they don't speak English very well, whereas the kid speaks English fluently because he was raised in the States. And so there's this kind of language barrier and the parents are finding it difficult to really communicate effectively. And the dad has decided to work a lot and kind of just, he's sort of given up having a close relationship with his kids. And so he loves his kids through working a lot, through, providing for a good house and a good education, and by being very harsh about the grades. But deep down, he wants to love his son, but he doesn't know how. And you, in your geniusness, you manage to facilitate loving interactions between father and son. And then the talks about grades disappear. The kid starts doing better in school because he isn't preoccupied with being neglected. So that's what I mean about look for the human universals, not the cultural specifics. The same goes for the belt. Having said that, does abuse happen in families? Yes. Does abuse need to stop? Yes. Is abuse potentially more indicative in one culture than another? Yes. But you have to be very careful about making those kinds of judgments. So what's the bottom line? Culture is weird. Culture is weird. Psychotherapy is weird. Recognize your bias. And this takes more than a lifetime. So just start down that path. Be tentative. Don't be a know-it-all. Check your countertransference. Check your cultural countertransference. Talk about your culture with people, including your clients. Ask clients about their culture. Join with the system. Don't judge from afar. Really get in there and see what it's like from a unknowing position. Really, you know, get in there and don't judge them right away. Know that your gut is not a good barometer, particularly when you're interfacing with another culture. Build strong relationships with your clients. Build strong alliances before you even engage in any kind of advice about a parenting practice. Make sure the client is asking for your help, and don't get frustrated with a client who isn't really asking for your help. If a client isn't asking for your help about something, it's going to, and you're trying to help them with that thing, it's not going to work and you're going to get frustrated. The best therapy and the place you want to try to engineer your therapy toward is where the client sits down on your couch and says, "So I really want to talk about my parenting and I don't know what to do. Can we talk about my parenting?" That's where you want to be. If a client is not saying anything in that category and they're not asking for your help with their parenting, then you can't start talking about their parenting yet. And you can't even start evaluating their parenting because there's no point in evaluating their parenting because they haven't even asked you for help about their parenting. So you got to back up, build a relationship, start talking about, you know, what you can offer them. Maybe diplomatically convince them that talking about parenting might be a good idea. And this is all before you start, you know, evaluating their parenting. Because until they ask for your help, you know, until they like you, until they trust you, until they're saying, "Yes, I would like therapy for my parenting," you can't engage in any kind of interventions yet. Now, again, that's a simplistic statement. There are some clients who will absolutely respond to things before any of those things happen. That's what makes psychotherapy so great because it's so varied, as I said before. So make sure the client is asking for help. Once they ask for your help, offer other methods before taking away a method. Get good at demonstrating the benefits of other parenting methods. Get good at understanding other parenting methods. Get good at understanding other methods of life. Continue to engage in discourses with people who don't think like you. That's important. In our echo chamber world, we tend to only engage in discourses with people that completely agree with this. And what that results in is a bunch of tiny little groups of people who start believing very strange things because there's no one to oppose them. So you have to get good at engaging in discourses, conversations, respectful conversations with people who don't think like you. I'm not necessarily talking about Democrats, Republicans. I'm talking about things like, you know, emphasis on grades or using a belt to discipline a child. You know, really enter into a discourse with them before you make a judgment. Absorb as many perspectives as possible. After I absorb a new perspective, I get a new gestalt that emerges and it feels like wisdom to me. The more discourses I enter into with people who disagree with me. I mean, you know, doing this podcast, I'm getting, you know, all sorts of negative emails all the time. And always my first impulse is to reject. But when I'm at my best, I say, okay, don't reject. What are they saying? Where are they coming from? What's their perspective? What informs what they're saying? How can I see what they're saying? How can I see it as legitimate? When I do that, not only does it feel better because I take it less personally and I can, if I understand why people are saying things, then it doesn't feel like an attack. Not only that, but I feel the fiber of my being changing. I can feel it almost, I can almost feel it physically of myself, you know, adapting to another person's reality. And with that additional lens, I see the world in a slightly different way. And every time I do that, I feel like I get a greater understanding of what it is to be human. And through that, it makes it easier for me to have compassion for more and more people and to understand more and more people. So that is what I will end with. That does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Patreon, let me know what you think of this. I could be off base. Your email wasn't that long, so I'm not even sure if I, you know, maybe I didn't really even understand what you're trying to tell me. So feel free to tell me, Kirk, I think you didn't understand my email. I get that sometimes. People will say, Kirk, I was being sarcastic when I said that. So, you know, maybe I completely had the whole thing wrong. But let me know. And also, if you have something to add to the discourse, send me an email. contact@psychologyinseattle.com. That's contact@psychologyinseattle.com. Add to the discourse, let me know. Or participate on the Facebook fan group on Facebook. It's not the official Facebook page for Psychology in Seattle. It's a fan group, and there's a lot more activity amongst the listeners, much more discourse, shall we say, which I'll occasionally peek in on and marvel at how smart you guys are. All right, that does it for that episode. Thanks for joining me. Please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You deserve so much in life. And try to manifest that for yourself. You deserve a good night's sleep. You deserve a good meal. You deserve people to love you and take care of you. You deserve to be happy.